Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. Tonight, our speaker, Angela Ferguson, partner at the Austin and Ferguson Law Firm, will discuss her perspective on what's really going on with immigration under the Trump administration and how an invisible wall of fast-changing legislation might become more effective than any physical barrier. This show was recorded on October 7th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our show begins with the speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then concludes with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI.
Good morning. I'm Rita Norton, a member of the forum committee that organizes these platforms for the discussion of significant issues, especially those that involve ethical issues in the contemporary world. Most of us are immigrants or the descendants of immigrants. Whether our families have been in the United States for 50 years or 500 years, unless we are descended from the indigenous peoples between Mexico and Canada, we are, nearly all of us, immigrants and the children of immigrants. Yet the powers that be increasingly fail to see that which has made the United States what it is. Today's speaker, Angela Ferguson, deals with this reality every day. Angela is also a crucial part of the Metropolitan Organization for Racial Equity and Employment, Moore Square. Angela.
All right. Thank you guys for coming out on this lovely morning. It's always good to be here, and I appreciate the invitation to speak today, and I look forward to your questions. So last Sunday, I was sitting out in a field over in Columbia listening to Sturgill Simpson. Any of you know Sturgill Simpson? Yeah, well, he's a musician over at the Roots and Blues Festival. He got on stage and he said, I don't need any effing playlist, right? He was just going to shoot from the hip. And in my mind, I hear President Trump saying, I don't need any effing wall. He's got Jeff Sessions helping him build the invisible wall. And so today I'm going to talk to you about the invisible wall that's being constructed by our government right now. And it's doing much more damage than the physical wall on our southern border, even though all of us would end up paying lots of money for that physical wall. The invisible wall is going to hurt us a lot more than the brick and mortar wall. First one, I'm sure you guys have been hearing about the public charge rule that has been proposed. It's been all over NPR. I get so many phone calls about the public charge rule that has been proposed by the government. It's not in effect yet. It will be produced. It's about 400 pages long. It'll be produced in the Federal Register, and then there's time for comments, and who knows what we'll end up with. But the term public charge, as applied to the admission of aliens to the United States, has a very long history in U.S. immigration law. It has appeared in our law as far back as the Immigration Act of 1882. In the late 19th century and early 20th centuries, it is the most common ground for refusing admission into U.S. ports of entry. People seeking to immigrate into the United States must show that they can support themselves, that they're not going to become a burden financially on the United States. The Trump administration has proposed this new regulation that has not yet gone into effect, but it has changed the definition of public charge and expanded the application so that more people will be kept out. Currently, if you want to immigrate to the United States, you have to have an affidavit of support, a contract by your financial sponsor with the U.S. government, promises. A person shows that they have enough money to support you, promises that you will keep them off the welfare system for 10 years or until that person becomes a U.S. citizen. People coming, immigrating to the United States are not becoming a burden on the taxpayers. They're not eligible for welfare. But this expanded rule would apply it to local, state, federal, and even tribal cash assistance. It will not affect asylees or refugees. They'll still be eligible for some limited benefits, or to women who qualify under, or people who qualify under the Violence Against Women's Act. But for the most part, if this rule goes into effect, it will make it more difficult. But what it really will do is give the officers at Immigration and Border Patrol, or the State Department at the consulates, give them much more power to use their discretion to deny someone. In my mind, the people that I see being harmed the most by this rule, when and if it goes into effect, people who have immigrated to the United States, have had their green cards, they've become citizens, and they want to sponsor their parents to come join them in the United States. And if you're sponsoring an elderly person to come to the United States, you can anticipate that there might be some medical issues coming up. Medical issues are not a reason to refuse entry for a parent into the United States when a child has sponsored their parent. But in discretion, it could be taken into account that this person may have some extraordinary medical issues that might cause a financial burden. They could use their discretion to keep family members out from the legal immigration process. Oh, let's see. Let's talk about those unaccompanied children. Number two, brick in the wall. We've had some members of our church go down to the southern border and observe what's going on with the tent city, the tent detention facility for the unaccompanied children that are being housed in cages and tents and in foster care facilities throughout the United States. Well, many of those children were coming here to join a family member, right? A parent or whoever, a grandparent is taking care of the children in Central America, the child in Central America. Child's getting to be a teenager, maybe getting into trouble, or maybe being recruited by one of the gangs, and the child is sent. The relative here in the United States, maybe a parent or an aunt or uncle, says, I'll take care of them, let's get them safe, send them to the United States, and they come. Sometimes the kid just runs away from home. And they come to the United States, and they're put in this tent facility or into foster care. And they provide the volunteer or the Health and Human Services with the name or the phone number. They got a piece of paper, something in there on themselves that has the contact information for the person they were coming to join. Well, a new policy of the Trump administration is to use that information to pick up the undocumented potential guardian, right? So JVS, Jewish Vocational Services here in town, is one of the facilities that has a contract with the government to do background checks, to help with background checks for the potential guardians. They contacted me recently. They said, we have this contract, and people from four states have to drive to JVS to get fingerprinted to start the background process so that they can get a child out of the foster care system. And they do that, but JVS was concerned because this information now has to be turned over to ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, so they can check the family member out for their immigration history. So in the last 4 months, from July until September, there were 41 people who came forward to take custody of their child, and 70% of those were arrested for being undocumented. What's that do? It means that people aren't going to come forward and claim the children. And the population in those facilities has just skyrocketed. Right now, we have over 13,000 children in custody as of September the 20th. The average length of stay has doubled since 2016, and the crowding in those jails has caused them to triple the size of the tent city down there in on the southern border. It's pretty outrageous. And here's another kicker for you. The Trump administration has moved $260 million from cancer research and HIV/AIDS research to fund the tent city. It's having ripple effects. It's going to affect all of our lives. According to Bob Carey, who ran the HHS office that oversaw the child detention under President Obama, these children are fleeing some of the most violent countries in the world. Many of them have experienced trauma, rape, robbery, and all kinds of exploitation. And the question that he asks is, are these measures legitimately enhancing security? The ultimate security is not releasing any child to a sponsor, right? Because then nothing would happen to them. But how much harm are you causing by keeping the kids in custody indefinitely in settings that were never designed for that? A tent on the southern Texas border in the wintertime is not going to be, any time, in the summertime, is not a place for a child. So let's move on to brick number three of this wall. So when these asylum seekers, people coming to the United States to our southern border, when they're coming to the southern border seeking protection, and if they are lucky enough to get released, they have to continue their court process. Wherever they're headed in the United States, they go and they're assigned to a court hearing date. And here in town, we have immigration court at the Lathrop and Gage building downtown. It's open to the public. You can go up and watch some of these hearings. It's always interesting to observe. So if you got time to go down for coffee in the Lathrop and Gage building, there's a coffee shop on the first floor. Go up to the fifth floor, walk in, go through security. It's pretty light. You just have to have an identification and say what you're there to observe. It's open to the public. Drop in if you can. Well, an immigrant goes through this process down here at the local court, and if they lose, they have the right to appeal to the federal, to the Board of Immigration Appeals, and then on up to the Federal Court of Appeals. We're living in the Eighth Circuit here, and on immigration issues, I can't imagine a more conservative court. I unfortunately have to write appeals on the asylum cases all the time, and it's hard to find a favorable case on any asylum issue in the Eighth Circuit. We have 13 courts of appeals, 11 that cover states, and then we have a patent court and an appeals court for District of Columbia. Supreme Court only hears about 100 cases per year, and very few immigration issues make it up to the Supreme Court. If you thought that you could get out of the forum today without hearing the word Kavanaugh, think again. It's going to have an effect on immigration cases that do reach the Supreme Court. But the real issue is the courts of appeals. President Trump is rapidly filling any vacancies in the courts of appeals. And, a lot of the liberal majorities on the courts are going to be switching over to conservative control. So far, he's appointed 26 appeal court judges, and that's more than any other president in the first 2 years of a presidency. President Obama only appointed 55 in his 8 years as president. There's currently 13 openings on the courts of appeals, and it's going to get worse from here, right, for immigrants. If you think that it doesn't matter to us on these court appointments, in the 11th Circuit, the state of Alabama, there's a current appeal on raising the minimum wage, right? We had that issue here in Missouri, where the city of Birmingham wanted to raise the minimum wage and the state has appealed that. It's just like the Missouri and Kansas City or St. Louis issue. The three-judge panel ruled in favor of the city of Birmingham, and the state has asked for a review by the full entire 12-judge panel. If that request is granted, then the conservative majority would have a chance to reverse that. In the Third Circuit, the Trump administration is appealing a judge's ruling on sanctuary cities. And the lower court has stopped the Justice Department from cutting off grants to the city of Philadelphia over its sanctuary city policies. By stacking the courts with conservatives, more and more of our rights are going to be eroded, in my opinion. Every one of these appointments matters, not just the Kavanaugh appointment. So let's talk about brick number four, the refugee admissions. Anyone heard about the refugee admissions? Yep, they're going down. You got it. The Trump administration has announced that the refugee admissions for fiscal year 2019 will be 30,000, a record low. In fiscal year 2018, the cap was set at 45,000, but only about 22,000 were actually resettled in the United States as of September 30th, the end of the fiscal year. The administration has consistently set up roadblocks for those who are trying to start a new life here in the United States, starting with that initial ban on refugee admissions right after the travel ban. The first week after he took office, there was a complete halt to refugee resettlement for 120 days, and it hasn't gotten much better after that reopened. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo just recently justified the cuts, saying that we need to cut the refugees coming in because we're going to deal with the 280,000 or so pending asylum cases that are here already in the United States. Refugees are folks who are coming in from outside of the United States who have gone through some extreme vetting to enter, and it's taken years to be accepted. Well, the asylees are people who are here on U.S. soil and who apply for the same kinds of protections, and they go through the court system, through the asylum office and then through the immigration court system. You know, I'd say the statistics show that approximately 90% of those asylum cases are rejected, are denied by our courts here, and the individuals are usually eventually deported. Claiming that processing these asylum cases should be considered when measuring the United States' generosity towards protecting people is pretty lame. And there you go. And Sessions has repeatedly undermined the rights of asylum seekers, people who are coming here asking for protection. Jeff Sessions is the Attorney General of the United States. He's the boss of the immigration judges, right? And if he doesn't like the direction the courts are going, he refers the case or the issue to himself to change the directions, right? And we saw that recently when Jeff Sessions in, I think it was June or July, referred the issue of domestic violence to himself. In 2014, the Board of Immigration Appeals acknowledged that gender and domestic violence in some countries, when the country has such a horrible record of protecting people who are victims of domestic violence, that can be a qualifying ground for asylum in the United States. And Jeff Sessions reversed that decision back in July and set that aside. And, oh, by the way, as an aside, he threw in and also victims of gang violence. So as a general rule for all of the immigration judges across the nation, if the claim is that you are a victim of gang recruitment or gang violence, it's not going to be considered a ground for asylum. We have to keep trying to find ways around exceptions to that rule, but Jeff Sessions has just made it much more difficult for any relief for those 280,000 pending cases. Oh, let's see. Asylum and refugee process here in the United States is just in turmoil, and I'd love to talk to any of you some more about ways that we could work here locally to help help some of the folks seeking protection. The immigration process for these refugees and asylees is going to get even worse, because another step that Jeff Sessions took a couple of weeks ago is referring a case called MGG to himself. And what he has, what we anticipate will be coming out imminently is a decision that the immigration judges cannot set bond for these people that are detained on our southern border, taking away the power of these individuals to prove that they're not a flight risk, that they're not a danger to the United States, that they want to pursue their case in court here. And instead, the detention facilities are going to continue to grow, the private prisons are going to continue to profit, and the people will be detained until their cases are finished, which could be years. In the meantime, they're hiring many more immigration judges and setting up new courts in Texas and throughout the southern border so that they can handle these cases quicker. But the people will not be able to get out if he takes away the power of the judges to grant bonds. Detention is costly, and it's a waste of our resources and the human resources of the people that are sitting there in jail. The next brick in the wall. You know, this administration's policies doesn't just affect the asylees or the refugees or the children. It's also affecting the high end of immigration. The invisible wall is being built up to keep out the professional workers also. And it's a result of the Trump administration's new policy, Buy American, Hire American. And it is maybe not a bad thing, but this is how it's working. You know, a rich family will send their child to the United States to get educated. They'll get a student visa, they'll come into the United States, they'll get to pay triple the cost of what our kids would pay for a college education. They get their degree, they might get their master's degree, and then they get a job offer. And if a company likes their work, they can sponsor them for a temporary professional visa to work in Cerner or Sprint or any kind of industry that's a professional job offer. And once that's done, if the company wants to sponsor that person for permanent residence, they can go through the Department of Labor to prove that there's a shortage of an American worker that they've recruited. They can't find a worker for this position. And if it's approved, that person can get their green card. Well, it's really important for that worker to remain in perfect immigration status and not have any periods out of status during that entire time. Before Trump, it was a long process, but it was completely possible. But now, with government delays, it's causing many of the temporary workers to fall out of status. It's a new policy that says we don't have to follow any of our prior decisions. If a prior decision has been made on a case, we have complete power to review it and slow it down. Okay, well, that's not bad on its face, right? Maybe they're reviewing to see if mistakes were made in the past. Well, it is causing chaos in the employment field. I'm going to give you a couple of examples from a couple of my colleagues. First, there's an Indian doctor. He has had an H-1B, a professional visa, for years. It's been extended twice. His last extension has been denied for no reason. He's out of status. The hospital can still sponsor him to come back to get his green card, but in the meantime, he's going to have to return to India. You know, upsetting life, family, the stability that he has built here in the United States. Nothing had changed in his case. He still had the same job, same credentials. He hasn't been stripped of his medical license or anything, just a delay by this government. Bob's case involved a Fortune 200 company that had employed an information technology storage engineer since 2014. His H-1B was just denied. Although the employers can eventually bring these people back, the disruption in employment and the replacement and the instability is causing a lot of pain. A denial of, let me tell you about a case that we have in our office. We represent a school district. We help a school district bring in math, science, and special education teachers. We've done it for years. They don't want to spend the money to bring in foreign workers. They just simply can't find the teachers that will fill these positions. The most recent requests for evidence or challenges to the cases that we have on renewals of these teachers' ability to continue working, the challenge is prove to us that the school district is a nonprofit organization. Kansas? Are you kidding? A nonprofit public? Yeah, prove that. It's ridiculous, but it slows things down and it throws the workers' employment in jeopardy. Those are things that are causing turmoil in the immigration field these days. I'm going to tell you about a few ways that there's some resistance going on, the ways that we're working to tear down the wall, right? Because we have to. We have to keep fighting. I hope that some of you have an opportunity to talk with Roxanne and her husband from here in the church. They recently went down to work in that South Texas facility to see what they could do to help with those children. They were part of the resistance, and I'm sure that they have some good stories to tell. Every night in the United States, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement is required this year to have 40,520 beds available for detainees. ICE doesn't have that many detention facilities in the United States. So they contract with local agencies, with local counties to use their jail space. Here, locally, we have contracts, or ICE has contracts. They pay Jackson County and Wyandotte County and Platte County and Caldwell County and others to detain immigrants for short-term periods. The detainee bed cost is about $208 a night. We, in our budget right now for the United States government, has about $3.076 billion for those beds. The counties make money off of this contract, and they're pretty happy detaining immigrants because they're not criminals, most of them. These are just temporary civil violations, and the person, once they're out of the local county jail, they're able to pursue their case in immigration court, which is not criminal court. It's a civil court. And so the counties, you know, like these contracts. They make good money. But there are certainly counties around the United States that are resisting, that are refusing to house detainees for ICE. And I think that it's one thing that maybe we need to work on here locally, is to get our counties to stop helping with the detention. Atlanta, Georgia, you guys have heard, we've had speakers here at the forum for the Deportation Defense Legal Network. They got started because of some of our local people who have a connection to a family member that was detained in Atlanta, Georgia, and thrown into solitary confinement, a young man who was in just out of his immigration status, and he was being deported, and he was sent to the Atlanta, Georgia facility, and he committed suicide in solitary confinement. There are all kinds of violations in some of these facilities, and so counties have well, they've been sued for their violations, but they are also deciding to cancel these contracts. Atlanta, Georgia, Williamson County, Texas, Sacramento, California, Oregon, Virginia, there are places where they're resisting this detention, and we should be asking our local governments to stop these contracts and quit detaining. It's a lot of work. We need to find a way to do it. And if you're interested in getting involved on at least checking this out and seeing what we could, what kind of pressure we could bring on some of our local governments, the Moore Squared Immigration Task Force meets on the third Mondays of each month, and this is an issue that we could start working on. I'll be outside after the forum. Well, we'll have time to talk down the hall, but also during church or after the service, I'll be there to talk about ways you could get involved with Moore Squared if you're interested in this immigrant task force. Another way that you guys can help is an easy one, okay? We just need to simply change the narrative about the way we talk about our immigrant neighbors and our friends. I was having a conversation earlier about how the media and how movies are simply the way we have learned about immigrants, and how some of that narrative is pretty negative, and we need to start changing the narrative on how our immigrants are talked about and perceived here. The Census Bureau releases the American Community Survey every year, and the 2017 data shows that one important way that immigrants add value to the economy is through their participation in the workforce. I mean, when you're having these conversations around your family dinner table or with colleagues, these are some of the things that you can bring up. Immigrants comprise about 13% of the workforce, and yet they account for, 13% of the population, but they account for 17% of the workforce. They're found at both the high end and the low end of the educational spectrum. 2 out of 5 immigrants do not have a high school diploma, but immigrants make up 1/3 of all adults with college degrees. Immigrants are employed in the less skilled and the highly skilled ends of the job spectrum. You know that. You see it. I hope you see it. They make up 1/4 of the workers in the construction industry and 1/5 of the professional, scientific, and management industries. Immigrants do not replace native-born workers. They complement the native-born workers. You guys see that? I hope that you do. For example, a construction site that employs a number of Spanish-speaking laborers is going to increase the demand for native-born bilinguals to fill the supervisory positions. At the other end of the spectrum, an increase in the supply of less skilled construction workers may increase the demand for architects and engineers and skilled craftsmen. The skills complement each other. And remember that immigrants are not just laborers, they're also consumers, and they sustain the jobs of other workers. They're also taxpayers that add to the revenue stream of government at all levels, and they're entrepreneurs who start new businesses. If you just take a look around town, you're going to see a bunch of new businesses that are started by immigrants here. Drive up and down Central Avenue or Independence Avenue, you're going to see the changes that immigrants have brought to our neighborhoods. Changing the narrative, whether it's on Facebook or any kind of social media or in your conversations around the Thanksgiving table, it's an important little piece of resistance that each one of us can do. We also are continuing our resistance work here locally. You know, through the courts, and we've got one volunteer here who's going to start helping us with bond cases. We've set up a pro bono team to take on deportation cases to help people get out of detention here locally. But when a family member is picked up, we have a network of folks that are helping support the family that's left behind. If you're interested in doing transportation or helping out a family or childcare or something like that, we're working to get this network put together so that we can provide that kind of support on the ground. We're raising money for bonds. Sometimes these families just simply can't afford the bonds that are set. And so the Deportation Defense Network and Village Presbyterian Church and another organization I'm with, the Advocates for Immigrant Rights and Reconciliation, we put together a bond fund, and we will donate a portion to the family to help them get out. There is so much work that needs to be done, and we could use any help that you could provide. And with that, I'm going to pass this on to Rita, and then be happy to take any questions you have. Thank you.
We'll pass it right back.
And now please remember the rules for questions. Come to the mic to ask your question. One question per person until everyone has had an opportunity to ask a question. And please, no speeches. We will have some conversation time after 11. Please speak clearly and into the microphone.
I wondered if you could compare and contrast the United States' responsibility for refugees and asylum seekers who come into the country with the United States' responsibility, if any, and effectiveness toward dealing with the cause of some of these problems in other countries.
Oh, man, that's going to take another hour. Oh, just briefly. I think that the United States has done a pitiful job of taking in refugees. And I was just on a panel on Friday where my co-speaker had all of the statistics for all the other countries and the numbers that they have taken in. And we have certainly not done our part. One of my friends, Judy Ansel, was recently speaking with me, and she pointed out something that I just really hadn't thought about much in the past, that our long lines for visas coming to the United States, our longest lines are the Philippines, we've got El Salvador and Guatemala, Honduras right now, China. These are places where the United States has interfered in their governments, has caused disruption in their governments, and particularly in Central America, the problems that we have helped create by interfering and by the MS-13 and the Mara Salvatrucha gangs that are creating havoc down there are partly a result of our policies and the work that we have done in Central America. And we've caused some of those problems, and we're not helping solve them. It's huge, and it's... I don't think that this flow is going to stop from Central America until there's major changes there, and we're not addressing it at all. I would like to come back to one piece of that. The Obama administration tried to help create a program called the Central American Minors Program to allow children who were in Central America who had issues with the gangs or wanted to apply for refugee status from Central America. It was a program that was created under the Obama administration. It took a long time for it to actually get started and start working. They were allowed to come into the United States if they could prove they were in danger and they had a family member here in the United States who was legal. That program had just gotten up and running. There's about 3,000 or so kids that were approved but had not come to the United States yet, and the Trump administration has just terminated that program, so they will not be able to come legally, and most likely they'll end up here on our land in one of those detention facilities because they'll come anyway. That's my guess. Sorry, that was very brief.
In the last 30, 40 years, immigrants have comprised a large part of the workforce of slaughterhouses and animal factories where they raise the animal in deplorable conditions. And there's, since I follow that issue, I've seen a certain amount of panic among the industrial agriculture people. So they're now actually promoting publicly the idea of employing prisoners in state penitentiaries. And I know of cases where they're actually doing this, but they're actively promoting it. Well, my question to you is, how long is it going to be before they're, since they're the same political class, essentially, how long is it going to be before they start wanting to employ these detainees, immigrant detainees, for this purpose?
Yeah, I wouldn't be at all surprised. There is a lawsuit going on about the forced labor that is happening within the immigrant detention facility, so I don't know how that will come out. But right now, because of the election that's pending on the Kansas side for governor, it's causing a lot of panic amongst the big ag folks over there, particularly in the dairy industry. They have invested in facilities here in the Midwest, moving them from California to the Midwest because of the lower costs and the available labor. They employ a lot of folks. And depending on who wins that governor's race, there is a promise that undocumented will be run out of Kansas, right? And there's panic amongst the ag industry. And they are looking to see what alternatives they will have. And turning to the prison industry, I'm not surprised at all. It's sad. But we need to make sure to pay attention to that race over there and get turnout for this vote. Immigrants help Kansas. Yes?
Butch Murphy. Mm-hmm. The low unemployment rate, you may have covered that in the United States. Can you talk about the corollary with all the signs for needing workers? Is that related to, do you think it's related directly to the, or somewhat related directly to the reduction in immigration into our country?
Well, I think that the extremely low unemployment rates will maybe be the reason that the administration or the Republicans come around to creating a new immigration act. It may be the impetus for reform that we need, because we need to allow the workers to come in legally. That would be my dream, is that we have a positive immigration reform that will make it easier for employers to be able to get the workers here legally that they need. But many of our employers already have the workers that they need here. They're filling the jobs. They're doing the work. They're just undocumented. And the extreme enforcement that's going on now, I mean, the crackdown on the employers is happening more than ever right now, where the companies are being investigated and employees are being picked up. Hopefully, Congress will maybe get their act together and address the needs of our employers so that immigrant employees can be obtained. Well, yes?
Hi. So I'm really glad that you mentioned the professional worker visas and that kind of process, because in my personal experience, I know a lot of people who are on those type of visas or are in that process. And the growing almost consensus that everyone that I've talked to in that situation feels like their employers are taking advantage of them because they know that they really can't go anywhere else because they're being sponsored. So they're not being paid very well. Like, their rights are kind of being like trampled on because basically the employer has them hostage, because it's like, if you want to work here, you want to live here, you want your green card, or you want this in the future, you have to stay with us. So is that something that you often see maybe in your practice, or is this something that people say personally and they just don't really feel like they have any recourse in that mm-hmm. kind of situation? I'm just wondering how that yeah. kind of works out for these people, because I wish that there was something they could do, but it doesn't feel like it.
Well, what happens is if a person applies for a job and the employer agrees to sponsor them for the H-1B, you're approved for that employer, not for anyone else, right? And if you want to go work somewhere else, you can do that. You need to apply to that company, and they have to sponsor you, and you're not allowed to start working until you're approved. It's not impossible to switch jobs. It just is expensive. And if I was an employer and I wanted to fill a position, I would not choose an immigrant to fill my job because it's expensive. It's expensive to pay for an H-1B worker. And you are required to pay the prevailing wage. There's the Department of Labor reviews the job description and tells the employer what wage is required for this position. And if there's a violation, if they're being underpaid, if they're being violated in any way, the employer will be punished through the Immigration Service, through the Department of Labor. So if that is happening to an H-1B worker, they absolutely need to report it. But if the employer is meeting all of the requirements of the visa and the employee is just unhappy, they need to search for different employment. You are tied to the employer who has sponsored you and who has been approved. Once the labor process for permanent residence starts, it's not impossible to change employers during the process once you've reached a certain stage of the permanent resident process. So you can float. But I'm sure that there are abuses that go on. That's not what I see.
Mm-hmm. I've got two questions. Who is the largest individual investor in private prisons in the United States?
I don't know. Do you know the answer to
yes,
that
I
one?
Do.
Oh, good. Tell us, please.
It's Jefferson Davis Sessions.
I'm not surprised.
He is the largest, not institutional, but individual investor.
See, he's part of building that wall, man.
Yeah. And secondly, how did the majority of undocumented immigrants arrive in this country?
Well, how did they?
They arrived legally.
All right, I believe that.
They just don't leave.
They don't leave. So our government has been pretty pitiful about tracking down people who come in legally. So folks come in on visitor visas, folks come in on student visas, and they simply overstay. And that's changing. I mean, that is definitely changing. Technology is increasing, and the numbers of ICE enforcement people are increasing, so that people are being tracked down. It's not as easy as it used to be to overstay. One thing I want to talk about, if we can, is this whole vetting process. So, we didn't hear that word very much, vetting, until after 9/11, right? That term vetting, a few years back we went out to lobby because Congress was talking about implementing extreme vetting or heightened security for folks coming into the United States. And, you know, the reality is that we already have a pretty good system of vetting folks that are coming in, applying for visas. They have background checks, and there's cross checks amongst the different countries' databases and blah, blah, blah. I mean, it goes on and on. But the increased vetting that has been put into place since Trump took office, and the reduction in folks from Muslim countries, the travel bans, has been pretty extreme, right? Terrible. Pretty extreme. And I'll just give you a few examples of the way that you and I are being harmed by this extreme vetting. In, I think it was February 2018, there's an executive order to establish the National Vetting Center. I don't know if it's been established. I don't know what kind of money has been put towards this, but I can imagine that it's not good and that it's coming out of our taxpayer dollars. One thing that has changed for folks, mostly from Muslim countries, is when you're applying for a visa, you now have to disclose your employment, your travel for the past 15 years, and the source of funds for all of your travel for the past 15 years, and you have to document it. You have to give your passwords for all of your social media for the past 5 years, okay? I can't remember the passwords I used last week, man. I got to look them up. This is part of the new vetting process. And as those officers are delving into the social media of all the folks that are applying, you know that they're also digging into our privacy, right? Our personal stuff, because if they're looking at Facebook, they're certainly coming across information about U.S. citizens, and it's all being accessed. So that's just one new way that our government is slowing down the issuance of visas to come into the United States legally. We had an Iranian, not one of my clients, it's just someone that I know about through our work with the American Immigration Lawyers Association, a 42-year-old neuroscientist woman from Iran who is an expert, an international expert on dementia and aging, someone that we could probably use in the United States. She wants to come to the United States. She would qualify for a national interest waiver, a visa to come to the United States. She has applied. It's probably not going to be issued because she's from Iran, and Iran is on our travel ban. So she's in the process of looking for other countries that will accept her. She knows that our government probably will not allow her here because she was invited to come speak at a conference and couldn't get the visitor visa to come speak at the conference. That's just one of our losses. That's an easy one to recognize, that we are the ones that are going to lose from that denial. But it happens over and over, all every day in immigration. So you guys, thank you for your time. And if there are no further questions, I'd be happy to talk down the hall. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Angela is available for further discussion in the library. Turn left as you exit the auditorium. Move down the hall to the second marked room after the cloakroom is on the right. First, however, our honorarium, our priceless but humble and U.S. and Union-made All Souls mug.
All right, thank you.
Next week's forum will be KKFI's Tom Crane discussing the people and music of Central Africa. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, Immigration with Angela Ferguson. This program was recorded on Sunday, October 7th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within one day of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation
here at 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.